The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. So, the people hear me okay? Okay. So, the topic that I wanted to discuss is that of truth. Truth is hopefully something that we cherish, we love, something that we find to be of tremendous benefit. And we could certainly learn to see the truth. We can learn to speak the truth. We can hopefully act truthfully. But also we can be the truth. And I think one of the purposes of Buddhist practice is not just to see the truth, but to become the truth. To internalize the experience of ourselves, experience of our life, experience of what's true, so fully that it's not something that we see that's separate from us, but becomes who we are. So it's a fascinating topic, and as I'm thinking about this morning, I'm also thinking about how powerful our minds are and how this negotiating or finding what's true has a lot to do with the health of our inner life, health of our mind. And the practice of mindfulness, the practice of insight, is a way of lighting up the mind, meaning bringing light to it. And now really seeing what's in there. Because falsehoods, lies, they do best in the dark. And when we kind of really see, light up, bring light to the mind, really see and start recognizing what's going on, it's generally very hard to continue with falsehoods. To see a falsehood is to see. To live in falsehoods, to live in lies, is to see yourself working unnecessarily. It's a lot of work to lie. It's a lot of work to resist what's true. It's some work, not as much maybe, to be deluded about what is true. And it's even less work perhaps to not know what is true. But as we wake up and see what's true, start seeing some of these this phenomena, one of them which is how much work it is to maintain what's false. And part of the reason why the truth is so valued in by practitioners is that it's just a lot less work. It's as we settle into the mind and see the mind, and you start feeling the tensions of the mind, the stresses of the mind, the churnings of the mind, it just starts feeling like, why live this way? Why resist something? Why keep spinning tales and stories? There's a well-known axiom that it's easier to tell the truth because then there's less to remember. But once you start a lie, you better remember it well, because, you know, what did I say and how did I say it? And so there's coming out of Indian Buddhism, there's a whole series of fables that are kind of like Aesop's fables in Greece, called the Jataka tales, meaning something like Jata means birth, so the birth tales. And many of them are kind of cute, and they involve animals. And there's thousands of these stories. And what they are supposedly these fables about past lives of the Buddha. Before he became a Buddha, he had many, many lifetimes. And there's these stories of these lifetimes, and sometimes he was born into an animal. One of the things that's kind of interesting about these past life stories of the Buddha, they don't always put him in a good light. You know, sometimes he's a robber, or he does different things. But the one thing, the one thing he never does in all these kind of stories is he never lies. They hold it up that you know, it's that important. And so there's one of these stories where the person, the being that was going to become the Buddha, was born as a fish, and in a lake with lots of other fish, small fish, big fish, all kinds of fish. And there was a drought. The rain stopped raining. And the lake began to dry out and got drier and drier. And all these fish started to burrow into the mud in order to both stay moist and also to be protected, you know, from being eaten by birds and stuff. But as the water kind of started to disappear and the fish were in the mud, the crows discovered these delicious meals to be had by simply pecking through the mud and pulling out these fish. So lots of fish were getting plucked out and being eaten. And now the Buddha-to-be, as a fish, he started feeling great sorrow that all his companions in the water were being eaten up. And he felt great compassion for what was going on. And so he exited the mud, got out of the mud, and kind of, I don't know, stood tall, or whatever way fish stand tall. You know, and he proclaimed, or he spoke to the rain god. And he said to the rain god, "In even though I'm a fish, a species of fish that eats smaller fish, in all my life, I have never eaten or killed any being, no matter how teeny and small it is." So what he's doing there is what in India is called a statement of truth, a claim of being truthful. It's making something that, and it's supposed to can be considered in India very powerful to make a truth statement like this. So he's making a, you know, especially if it has to do with our ethics, our ethical purity or something. So I've never killed, I've never eaten anyone. And based on this, rain God, please, out of compassion, rain on this lake. And the rain God did. And all the animal, all the fish were saved from the crows. So it's a little, you know, fable story, but it speaks to two things. One is certainly this mythic power of truth that it can have, but the truth of the Buddha's, that fish, inner goodness. And probably the rain god recognized, this is good. This is a beautiful thing, a profound thing. This is a valuable thing to have a mind, a heart that has this kind of purity or this kind of goodness in it. So when we sit and meditate and we turn our gaze inward and see what goes on in our minds and our hearts, what do we see there? Do we see something that from which we could make a truth claim to the rain gods? You know, since the time I was born, I never stole anything. Since the time I was born, I never lied. Or at least since last week. And there's a story of this murderer who the Buddha converted to become a monk and left behind his murdering life. And Buddha and this man were wandering for alms and through the town, and there was a woman giving birth who was having trouble with the birth, and so painful, probably screaming or in pain. And the Buddha said to this guy, to his new monk, he said, "Why don't you go make a truth statement to this woman and say, never in my life have I killed anyone." And he looks at the Buddha, I guess, and said, "What? That's not true. How could I say that?" "No, what I mean is, since you've been born into the monastic life, you've never killed anyone. And so the monk does, and the woman gives birth easily. So more of these fables, right? But it's speaking to the power of the pure truth statements having to do with the purity of the mind, the intention. So what can we find in ourselves that's like that? What can we discover that we can bring to the world? I mean, you don't want to go out in the street in Redwood City and just start proclaiming, you know, it's a little bit weird. But the fact that we become someone who's true, I think people can pick up and see. And the most important person who's supposed to pick it up and see it is you. If you can say that to yourself, that's a powerful thing. It's also powerful to be truthful towards oneself about all the strange things that are in there. Some of you probably have a few strange things happening, going on. And things that maybe you don't want to admit, things you're ashamed of, things that are challenging or you feel in conflict with, things that are, there's anger, there's greed, there's lust, there's all kinds of, you know, very challenging material that goes on in our lives, in our hearts, in our minds. There's something very powerful about acknowledging that and saying to ourselves, this is difficult. This is my difficulty. This is what's going on with me. You might not share it with other people if it's not wise, but the goal in Buddhist practice is to become a person who tells the truth to themselves and certainly never lies to themselves and discovers the truth about themselves. And as we discover what's true, even what's difficult within us, that is creating the space in the mind, the opportunities for the mind, the heart, to begin to heal, to begin to resolve itself, to begin to free itself from that. And to kind of repeat a little bit what I said earlier, it's almost mechanistic that I believe that this movement towards healing and resolution and freedom can happen because to be attached, to be resisting, to be caught up in anything at all in the mind takes a lot of work. To be contracted and tight takes a lot of work. It's stressful. And the whole psychophysical system that we have does not want to put in all this extra work, all this extra stress and pressure and resistance that goes on. And you can feel that when you sit to meditate. That's one of the tremendous values of mindfulness, is to really feel and sense and experience what's really going on here. Even if it's difficult to face, to really feel it and sense it and get to know it well, you'll notice that it wants to be free. It wants to release itself. Some people will explain this, interpret it or put words to it, that a deep yearning inside, a deep yearning for freedom or a deep yearning for truth or a deep yearning for spirituality or for meaning or something. And I think that sometimes this deep yearning is one way of articulating the innate, almost biological movement, desire almost, for the equivalent of water to run down the mountainside. The forces of our minds, activities of our mind, goes towards the gravity, goes downhill, goes towards where freedom is and openness, where there's not so much work. One of the words the Buddha gave for liberation is freedom from work, or putting all work to rest. And so to feel that that's there. And sometimes you've heard me say this, that it's kind of like if you hold your hand in a tight fist, a really tight fist, after a while you'll feel that the fist wants to relax. And if you don't want to relax it, then you have to put a lot of mental effort in to remember and stay on track to keep it tight. And if you get distracted, the hand will start releasing itself. If we could really turn and look at what goes on here and be honest about what's here and hold it in our kindness, then things begin to move and change. And I think one of the saddest things that I know, one very sad thing I know is the people I meet who are resisting acknowledging what is true. That they're holding back, closing down, looking in other directions, looking externally, rather than really turning the mirror back into themselves, seeing what is really true here, what's happening here. And I think of mindfulness practice, a synonym for mindfulness is honesty. I think the two are so closely together. And to not be honest is to go diametrically in opposite direction of what the whole purpose of mindfulness is to do, is to be honest, to really recognize and see what's there. The emphasis on truth, the word in Pali is satya, and in Sanskrit it's satya. And Mahatma Gandhi had this great expression that he coined, satyagraha, which means, I think it's usually translated in English as the power of truth. I think it literally means something like holding to truth. And it became the inspiration, I think, for Martin Luther King to come up with the term soul power. So translated into his idiom. And so the power of truth. And there's one a discourse in the suttas that talks about four truths, not the four truths we usually think of in Buddhism, that it's kind of touching to read. There's a bunch of religious people who are having a discussion. I think it's the subtext kind of is like they're having an argument about what are the real truths that other religious people or religious spiritual seekers, what's the real truths of that spiritual life? So the Buddha comes along and he asks them, what are you talking about? And he says, well, we're talking about what there might be the real truths of spiritual seekers or something. So the Buddha volunteers just to tell them, without being asked, to tell them, well, these are the four truths. These are the four truths that I have proclaimed, having realized them for myself with direct knowledge. So the Buddha says, I know things. Here, a seeker says thus, all living beings should not be hurt, should not be harmed. Isn't that a great first truth? That no one should be harmed. I don't know, I like this a lot. All living beings should not be harmed. Speaking thus, a practitioner speaks truth, not falsehoods. Isn't that an interesting idea? This is what's true? It's not, you know, it's a principle that's true, as opposed to, you know, what's true in reality. It's true for the heart. If you want to be free, if you want to do this inner work, this is a true statement. No one should be harmed. We should not be harming people. But then there's further idea of what this truth means. The seeker or the practitioner does not, on that account, misconceive oneself as being spiritual. One does not misconceive, I am better, I am equal, and I am worse than others. So they recognize this truth and somehow appreciate it maybe as a spiritual seeker or practitioner. But then we don't compare ourselves to others. And even the idea that we're equal to others in Buddhism is unnecessary. It's this extra work. There's a lot of work to compare. A tremendous amount of human suffering comes around comparing. And if you really sit quietly and look at your mind, you'll see that even conceiving, I mean, having the ideas, doing the inner work that says I'm equal to everyone, is extra work. It's so much better to just sit peacefully and not compare yourself to anyone. And you get a sense of that in meditation, right? You finally finally the thinking mind stops wandering off, you stop being preoccupied, and the mind is peaceful. And then you have, maybe it's very quiet and settled, and then this thought comes up, you know, a wonderful thought, I'm equal to everyone. And you feel how it's like, oh, I was so peaceful, why should I be thinking that? Why should I busy my mind with that thought? It's a nice thought, but let's it's better to go back in to the peace. So rather than misconceiving, having these thoughts about oneself, having directly known the truth, one practices simply out of compassion for all beings. And if some of you were here last week, the word that's being translated here as compassion is anukampa, out of care for all beings. So that's the first truth. Don't harm anyone and practice out of compassion or care for others. That's the first truth of Buddhism. That's pretty good. Again, a practitioner realizes all sensual pleasures are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and subject to change. So all sensual pleasures. In the Buddhist analysis of human life, the pursuit of sensual pleasure, sensual comfort, is one of the primary characteristics of human life. That, and it doesn't take a lot of analysis to consider that it's true for most people. In Thailand, there was a meditation teacher who would place people in a very, very comfortable recliner, you know, one of the softest ones he could find, I guess, in the monastery, and then tell people, don't move. Sit there and don't move. And even sitting in that beautiful, comfortable recliner, after a while, it starts getting uncomfortable unless you shift and move. And that shifting and moving was his, when people started doing that, was their lesson. See, you're pursuing comfort or sensual pleasure, trying to make yourself comfortable all the time. I don't know if that's the best way to get that lesson, but it was certainly an interesting way. But I think that a high percentage of human life has to do with making themselves comfortable, have pleasant things, pleasant food, pleasant environments, pleasant experiences, pleasant conversation, pleasant whatever. And a fair amount of what people do, at least around here, in terms of livelihood and earning money, it probably goes into buying things that aren't really essential for a healthy, good life, but are buy things that in order to be more comfortable. Buy a better car, you know, more than just to get yourself around, but something that brings you pleasure. To have a bigger house that brings you pleasure. To have nicer clothes, newer clothes, because it brings a sense of pleasure, perhaps. It goes on and on, all the things that people are doing to try to have more pleasure. And anyway, that's the Buddhist analysis. And so to emphasize that sensual pleasures are fleeting and permanent, in some kind of way unsatisfactory, there certainly are pleasures that can be enjoyed. But if we are depending on those enjoyable pleasures to provide us with lasting, secure, stable happiness, and that's all only way we know how to be happy, then we'll live a shallow life, and in Buddhist analysis, a fragile life. Because these sensual pleasures are so fleeting, they come and they go, then we have to constantly renew them. There was a Vipassana teacher many years ago who told the story of being taken on a long day hike, I think, into the mountains, some natural park. And it was supposed to be inspiring and beautiful. And she said, the whole experience was one discomfort after another. Some of us, you know, there are discomforts in hiking in beautiful places, but sometimes the pleasure or the beauty somehow outweighs the sore feet and the blisters and all the things that can happen. But she was kind of shocked, like the whole thing was uncomfortable. I don't know, you know, what lesson we want to make from that, but the anyway, so for the Buddha, so there's some kind of truth around the nature of sensual pleasure and the pursuit of it that the Buddha felt was very important for human beings. Second only to this idea, the truth of don't harm other beings. So it's a pretty, that's a pretty lofty or important or emphasis. So it's, I think it's worth considering, reflecting on. Speaking thus, the practitioner speaks truth, not falsehood. One does not, on that account, misconceive oneself as a practitioner. One does not misconceive, I am better, I am equal, I am worse. Rather, having directly known the truth in that way, one is practicing simply for the disenchantment with sensual pleasures, for their fading away and cessation. So then the third truth. Again, a practitioner says thus, all states of becoming are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and subject to change. Becoming, one of the easiest ways for us in our culture, I think, to understand this Buddhist word, becoming, is to think of them as identities. All identities are impermanent, unsatisfactory for lasting happiness, and subject to change. And then people say, what do you mean, my identity? You know, I'm a man or something. I'm a woman. And what? How's that changing? If you sit quietly in your mind, we can watch how we construct identities. We pick them up, the ideas that we latch onto. And these ideas of who we are shift and change very quickly if we're really watching the moment-to-moment unfolding of the mind. And in the ordinary busy life, we don't necessarily see how quickly our ideas, our thoughts, our concerns are shifting and changing. And it can feel like we're kind of latched on, like these things are permanent, they're always there. And they can oppress us, or we can get attached to them, or be holding on to them, or something. But to start seeing that these things flit through the mind very rapidly, they come and they go, they're not always there, begins showing us the gaps where our identities are not operating. And to sit in meditation, such a wonderful laboratory for seeing the mind, and to see how much peace and happiness, well-being there can be in those gaps when I'm no longer a man or a woman or some other gender. I'm just breathing. There's just awareness. And that begins to change our relationship to identities. Some people are deeply attached to their identities, attached to negative identities, positive identities, and identities of equality that we have. And we're oppressed by them, we're trying to defend them, we're trying to hide them, we're trying to assert them. The whole idea of our identification, who we think we are and how we represent ourselves, can be a source of tremendous suffering. And these are all, to really see the truth of their changing nature, is considered one of the liberating insights of Buddhism. And then this, almost like a refrain for each of these truths, kind of points to this idea of becoming, of identity. Speaking thus, all states of becoming are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and subject to change. Speaking thus, a practitioner speaks truth, not falsehood. One does not, on that account, misconceive oneself as a practitioner. One does not misconceive, I am better, I am equal, or I am worse. So that's all becoming, being someone, I am this way. Rather, having directly known the truth of this, one is practicing simply for disenchantment with all states of becoming, all states of existence, of identity, for their fading away and cessation. And then the fourth truth. Again, a practitioner says thus. So this is a little bit fascinating, what I'm about to read. It's kind of, maybe it's I am not anywhere the belonging of anyone. I am not anywhere the belonging of anyone. It's a kind of interesting statement. Not sure what it means. But, certainly they had slaves back in the Buddha's life. But the fact that we're independent, that we don't actually belong to anyone, that we're free of, you know, we're in relationship with people, but there's not a, we're not a possession of anyone. We're not obligated to anyone. You know, and maybe this refers back to, you know, the idea of slavery and serfdom that existed in the time of the Buddha, so that it was really understood as a powerful statement. But do we relate to other people in our lives as if we're their possession, or we belong to them, or they belong to us, and we're obligated in some way? Is that where freedom is found? Maybe that's comfort is found there, safety is found there. Maybe identity is found there, in that sense of belonging. But when we sit and meditate, again, this powerful reference point of a quiet mind is a reference point that begins questioning the operation of so many of the different ideas that we think are necessary for our life. And the idea of belonging, of possession, of somehow to other people, is that really conducive to the deeper peace and well-being that is possible for us? Then he goes on, nor is there anywhere, anything, in any place. So this is like a pretty powerful statements. Nor is there anywhere, anything, in any place that is mine. What do you mean? I bought it. I made it, you know. Nothing that is mine. So that's certainly worth considering. And if I may do this one more time, the reference to meditation practice, the quiet and peace of meditation practice, the thought, the idea, this is mine, can so obviously be experienced as more suffering. There's an example that's given sometimes on meditation retreats, that you have your cushion you've been using for many days on retreat. It's the cushion of the retreat center. You took it off the shelf the first day, but it's, you've been using it for 3 or 4 days. And it's not also to your place in the hall. And you come back after some meal or something, and you look, and someone is sitting in my place on my cushion. And this anger and fury and indignation and self-righteousness and hurt and all this stuff comes up. But then somehow you get it back and the retreat goes along nicely for another 3, 4, 5 days. And then somehow you put it back on the shelf at the end, and you'll never remember which cushion was yours again. You know, they all look the same, right? The idea that this is mine is a construct of the mind. Is it the wisest and best construct to use in all kinds of circumstances? And when do we want to question it? When do we want to find how to be liberated and free from that? When is it useful? When is it not useful? And for the Buddha to claim this is the fourth truth, I think is an occasion for some kind of pausing. We don't have to agree with him in all ways, but it is a powerful kind of statement to reflect on, and kind of like one of these wonderful practice slogans, and carry it with us and wonder, where is this true, and how is this true, and how is this useful? I am not anywhere the belonging of anyone. And maybe we can say, there is no one anywhere who is my belonging. Nor is there anywhere, anything, in any place that is mine. The Zen master Suzuki Roshi has it's a wonderful little story about him, about this idea of me, myself, and mine, my things. And he was in San Francisco in the 60s, and there's happens to be a photograph of him that was taken. He was talking to a small group of people, and someone happened to take a photograph of him just as he was saying it. So it's kind of a nice memory, you know, if you see the photograph. The photograph is him holding his glasses like this in front of his face and maybe putting it on or taking it off to demonstrate something. And he says, these glasses are not my glasses. but you know about my old tired eyes, so you let me wear them. That kind of reframes, you know, the idea, you know, of not mine. So, truth. There's a truth about ourselves, truth that we discover about ourselves, or the working of our minds, what's true about our goodness, what's true about what's challenging about ourselves, the true about our inner challenges that we want to face and be present for. And there's also a truth about certain principles about life that are often emphasized as being important or really true if we want to be free or want to live a good life. And that the first truth that the Buddha here evokes is one that's based on compassion, I think is a wonderful thing to consider, to live a life of care, live a life of feeling connected and concerned for the welfare of others, and to be dedicated to not harming anyone. The truth, the importance of not being involved in harming. To begin shifting our relationship to pleasure, and to discover a wise relationship to pleasure is a kind of truth that the Buddha here wants to emphasize. And so we look at our relationship to pleasure and we try to be honest about what that is. What are we using pleasure for? Are all the different purposes of pleasure that we're pursuing, is it really for our betterment? There's a lot of people who pursue pleasure to avoid their suffering, to avoid what's difficult, to distract themselves. Is that really the best thing to do in our life? Or do we want to somehow see that we're doing this, see the truth of that, and then look deeper? And then there's the truth of identity and becoming and asserting ourselves, making a self, conceiving a self. It's also a huge part of human psyche to turn around and use the mindfulness practice to be truthful and honest about what you're really doing around self-identity and how you conceive of yourself, how you think of yourself, how you are hiding from other people or asserting yourself or pretending. There's people who pretend to be a certain kind of self, and it's very difficult. So to be honest, to really look and see and be honest in that, and then to discover that that doesn't work, and then maybe there's another kind of freedom to be discovered that doesn't involve the pursuit of pleasure. And then this whole idea of belonging, that you are someone else's, that you're responsible or obligated or enslaved in some way to others, to a group of people, to family, to partners, to even to children, to parents. I think that it's a very complicated and a tender area of our life. What is our responsibility to each other as human beings? And when do we have responsibility and when don't we have responsibility for others? How much do we belong to someone other? How much are we connected that we have to take care of them or they have to take care of us? At what point do we become independent? You know, the idea, I remember for me that growing up, you know, I took my parents caring for me completely for granted. It never occurred to me that the universe was constructed in any other way. And but at some point, you know, it didn't make any sense anymore to count on my parents to take care of me. And so there was a weaning of myself from that parental, you know. And then at some point, it tipped, right? And then I became the caretaker of my mother, who now has a little bit of dementia. And so how much do we care for others? What is the responsibility, and how much do we belong, and where's that line? And it's not an easy thing to explore and discover. But to, again, turn the mindfulness back on ourselves and see what drives us. What are the fears? What are the attachments? What are the identities that come into play with this whole idea of responsibility for others? And this whole idea of mine, what is mine? And to like the mindfulness, shine the light on that. What do I feel like is what I possess, that's my thing, that I own? Or this is, you know, is it your opinions that are mine, that you hold on to? Is it your things? Is it your relationships? Is it your status? What is it that you take as mine? And is that really useful to do that? And to answer all these questions in whatever way you can, but to answer them, try to find what's honest, the truth of it, to really turn back and look at yourself, but to discover a truth which is not personal, but a truth of the freedom from all these attachments. The truth of the mind putting down its burden, its preoccupation. The mind no longer bound to its thoughts, its concepts, ideas, identities, pleasures, impulses of hate and anger and violence. To discover that freedom. And that truth shines light on all the other aspects of our life in a very powerful way, very meaningful way. So we sit to be true. We sit not to discover the truth, but to be able to relax and let go into who we are in a certain way, but a kind of who we are that needs no words to explain, needs no definition, that we can just be the truth. And we know we're being truthful because we're not lying. We're not conceiving. We're not making up things. We're just here in an open and clear and hopefully kind way for this world of ours. So truth. May you be a true person. So thank you. And I hope that many of you stay for the tea that we have. And enjoy the company, and those of you who might be new, especially this is a believe it or not a friendly group. even though they sit in silence for a long times, but if you just say hello to someone next to you or say hello, people will be kind and say hello and introduce themselves. So, thank you.